This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Reminder, you still have the rest of this month to go online and enter our contest to win 4 free tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood. All the details are online at hometownheroesradio.com. If you've looked at the photos there of the B-17 crash from April 12, 1944, you might find it hard to believe anyone survived that crash, but Nile Smith did. So did 8 other men, and it was a surge of adrenaline that helped Nile rescue some of those other airmen and pull them to safety. He was even able to lift a heavy radar dome weighing hundreds of pounds that had pinned one of the men to the ground. Before we left off, I mentioned a young lady named Phyllis. So let's get that story of how you met her, Nile.
About every 10 days on the base there, we get a 2-day pass and go down to London, like 2 or 3 of us go together. And that's what we did all during the war. But then the V-2s started coming in, the rockets.
Yeah.
They go up about 50 miles, and then they come straight down. And there's no warning or
right.
anything else.
You don't hear the putt, putt, putt.
Well, that was the buzz bomb, that
yeah.
putt, putt. But I was in London. This was, I guess it would be about August or something. August, one of those rockets hit about a block away from where I was. I was on the sidewalk, and the concussion threw me back against a brick wall, and I was off the ground about a foot, and I couldn't move.
Holy moly.
And there was people out in the street there that it killed. So I said to myself, this is the last time I'm going to London. I'm going someplace else, because I'm not dealing with these V-2s. So then I went up and started going to Scotland. They're going, you know, and that's how I met my wife.
Well, tell me the story. I mean, it's a lot to go through to have to meet your wife, you know, surviving this horrible plane crash when you're shot down and then almost getting killed by a V-2, and that's what it takes to send you her direction, huh?
I guess so.
How'd you meet her?
Well, about September of 44, I started going to Scotland. That's 400 miles from where the base was, and it's not like the train is now. The train does, I think, in about 4 hours, but you had to ride all night on that train from England to Edinburgh, and if there's an air raid, they stopped train, pulled
mm-hmm.
everything off. So it was an all-night journey up there, so I started going up there, and I don't know if it's the first visit or the second visit, like every 2 weeks we get time off. I went down to this, they called it the Palais de Danse. It was a big ballroom, and I saw her standing up there, and she was up on, I think, a balcony, and I kept looking at her, and I don't know if she was looking at me or not. Anyway, I went up and asked her to dance, and that's how we met.
And you'll have your 70th anniversary this December.
That's right, December 30th.
How about that?
Yeah.
You must have decided pretty quickly then that she was the one, because you guys got married while you were still over there. The war wasn't
yeah,
even over yet.
That's right. We got married in December. Yeah, it was quick. And we could only see each other every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah, so much for a honeymoon, right?
Yeah, we didn't have much of a honeymoon. Yeah, we went back down to where the base was, and I think we were in Norwich one night.
So how much longer were you over there?
Well, I was over there until the war ended May the 8th, 45. There's a story about that, too.
Let's hear it.
Okay, the day before, I had a buddy that worked up in personnel, and he came down and saw me. He says, hey, the war is going to be over tomorrow. I'm married by then, see. If you want a pass and you want to get out of here, you get your pass and get out, because they're throwing a restriction on the base. Nobody gets on or off when the announcement is made. So I got my pass, and Phyllis and I were sitting in the theater in Edinburgh when Churchill came on the screen and announced the war was over.
Huh.
And here's all these other guys back at the base.
Was there a big cheer in the theater when that announcement was made?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't tell anybody what I knew or anything, see, but I think people kind of knew it was going to happen.
Getting close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there any concern on your part that you might be sent to the Pacific?
I was supposed to be going to the Pacific.
What happened?
Well, see, the war was over. Then I don't know actually what happened to our outfit, but I had so many points. They had started a point system,
mm-hmm.
and because of... Well, maybe my medal had something to do with it. But I had enough points that I'd get sent back early to the state. But I was already on, I didn't have the orders, But I was told that I was going to be assigned to the 20th bomb group or whatever it was, the B-29s in the Pacific, and to go out there. But I came back in August of 45 and got a 30-day leave. And while I was on leave, while the war ended, so I didn't have to go. So then I got out then.
Was that a pretty big relief to you to know that the world was no longer at war?
Yeah, I didn't have to go. Didn't have to go to the Pacific because I didn't want to go to the Pacific. You'd go, but I didn't want to go.
Well, you had a wife to worry about now, too.
Yeah.
What was it like to be back home in America and to be introducing your war bride to all your family and friends?
It's something to start with, and then you just kind of get used to it. Everybody, you know, gets used to it. She didn't come right away, but she came in March of 46 before she came.
Uh-huh.
And she came on the Queen Mary.
Huh.
The first Queen Mary.
Uh-huh.
And here's, I don't know how many thousands of war brides up there. We stayed in New York for several months, and an aunt in New York, until we went to Illinois.
You know, so many people today don't know that much about World War II. It's so long ago now, and maybe people don't appreciate what the world was like or what it took to win that war. When you think about it, what gives you the most pride or the most satisfaction about what you did and all those other guys you knew did?
We did a job we had to do. I'd do it again, just like Vietnam. I didn't want to go to Vietnam, because that was a war zone too. But I went, and here's all other people trying to get out of it. But I went, you do your duty, you know, you go.
What'd you do over there?
I was first sergeant. This was a transport squadron. We had the planes, and many carried supplies back and forth, and I was at Cameron Bay. The Viet Cong tried to get in there. One night, they almost got clear in. They had three perimeters of defense around every base. And on the last defense, they had their dogs out there, see, police dogs. And they got clear into almost inside. The Viet Cong, I'm talking about, before they killed them. I wasn't into fighting or anything, but the Marines and the Army were there. Another fellow and me, we were up there looking at some of the Viet Cong that they'd killed, and this guy beside us, hell, I know that guy. He's one of the barbers in the barber shop here.
Wow.
So
that gets your attention. And was that any different for you, knowing that you had a wife and daughter back home while you were in Vietnam?
You think about it, but you don't worry about it. Something could happen. I mean, it could even happen on the way or on the way back or something, but or any place.
I've got a few more questions for you, and if there's anything I didn't touch on, I want to hear about it. But I'm just reflecting on that day in April of 1944 when this crash happens. And I guess the one thing, before I read your citation and ask you a couple other things, I'm just thinking about it, and I'm thinking of everyone at home listening, and they're saying, he wasn't supposed to be on this plane. He volunteers. He's on it. It almost claims his life. It did kill three others and severely wound all these other guys. He doesn't get to come home. He has to stay over there. If he doesn't, he's never going to meet his wife. His daughter's never going to be born. His three grandkids and five great-grandkids aren't going to be here.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible story. How do you make sense of all that? What do you credit for the way it all happened?
That's just the way the world is, I guess. Strange things happen all the time, or things happen you don't expect to happen, but that's the way it goes.
Is it something that you just say, well, that's luck, or do you think there was somebody up there pulling the strings for you, or what do you think?
I think there was that night. Yeah. It wasn't my time to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You mentioned the pilot coming to you in the hospital and thanking you for saving his life. So there were all these other survivors. There were, what, I guess 9 survivors and 3 killed. Did you ever, after the war and all the years past, have any contact with any of those other guys?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
I wonder if any of the rest of them are still living.
I don't know.
Maybe we can find that out.
There's not too many left anymore, you know.
That's the reason we do this show. Exactly. So we can know these stories. And I'm so grateful for you sharing it. Let me read this. This is what the government said about Sergeant, at that time, Corporal Niall Smith of the Army Air Forces. For heroism not in action against the enemy, displayed at a bomber base in England, 12 April 1944, when the plane in which Sergeant Smith was flying crashed into a field, 3 crew members were killed and 9 others, including Sergeant Smith, were injured. Despite his painful injuries and the imminent danger of the plane exploding, Sergeant Smith helped the co-pilot remove the pilot and other injured crew members, the plane blew up shortly afterwards. The bravery and utter disregard for personal safety displayed by Sergeant Smith on this occasion helped save the lives of the injured officers and men. His actions reflect the highest credit upon himself and the armed forces of the United States, and they awarded you the Soldier's Medal. Hearing that, thinking back to that, what does that mean to you, that they recognized what you did was something special?
Well, that means a lot. I mean, you know, it's just something that, you did your job and you did what you could, and I think most of the guys in the service were that way too. Even ones, and you read stories about Afghanistan or Iraq, wherever. You have a bunch of buddies, you know, and you're all for each other. You're protecting each other.
Amen. And the one thing that jumped out at me as I read this, and I'm sure you don't pull this out every week and look at it, but the first sentence there, they say, for heroism, not in action against the enemy. Well, your mission wasn't against the enemy, but it was an enemy plane that shot you down.
That's right.
I wonder if they re-examined this, if they'd say something different. And I showed you, too, something else that I found. There's a record of the German pilot who shot you down, and he was the same age as you, 21, shot down 4 Allied planes within a 2-week span and then died in a mid-air collision about 2 weeks after he shot you guys down. What's that like, to know the other side and to hear about this man who almost ended your life?
That's something that's hard to believe. You know, if you had met him someplace or somebody you could have known, you know.
Sure.
I mean, he was doing his job.
Well, Niall, I just want to say thank you for serving our country for those, what'd you say, 22 years, how many days?
2 months and 6 days. You never forget that either.
No, and I know the Air Force thanked you. But thank you for serving. Thank you for telling us this story that no one else could tell us. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know about you and all those other Americans who served in World War II?
Well, not really.
What's the secret to a 70-year marriage?
You just get along with each other, is all I know.
You make that choice, huh?
Yeah.
Were there any other incidents or occasions I didn't ask you about that you wanted to share?
Well, there was one time in Vietnam. See, I'd gone from our base down to Tonce Nut. That was a base sandwich near where I think they call it Ho Chi Minh City now or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'd caught a ride down there. I had to do something down there. I don't remember what it was. Coordinate some stuff. And I was catching a ride back. And I got a ride on a C-130 back to Cameron while we were on the plane, getting ready to taxi out and everything. Every cargo plane has what they call a loadmaster. He goes around and checks all the pallets,
right,
and the straps and everything, holding them down, so make sure nothing moves during flight. He was going around checking, and he went by this one pallet, and he saw this thing kind of sticking out. It was a hand grenade, and the pin was out of it.
Holy cow.
The slightest, it wouldn't take too much movement for that thing to fall out of there and, you know, blow up, and it could have brought the plane down. But so then everybody got off, and it took them, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour, to check that plane everywhere, wheel wells up in the wing, make sure there's nothing else there before we left. We got back on the plane and went back to Cameron. But you never know, you know.
Ooh, you've been through it. You've got some close calls. Somebody has been looking out for you.
And the day we came back from Tonce Nut, I mean, they weren't leaving from our base, but we went down to this main base. And the day before I went down there, the Viet Cong bombed the front of the passenger terminal. Mm-hmm. The whole front of it was gone.
Timing is everything.
Well, it was the next day I got down there. We were sitting there waiting on the plane. I look over to another table. Here's Robert Mitchum sitting over there.
Uh-huh.
Helping over and introduce myself. That's her autograph. Says, how you doing, Bob? He says, oh, okay, Smitty. Could I have your autograph? Sure. He scribbled the thing out.
That's funny.
Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, there's some good stories about Robert Mitchum doing some very generous things for the troops in Vietnam. And then when he came back to the States, he advocated for America's mission there and told America that the forces should not pull out of that situation. That was in 1966. And of course, Mitchum was, like Niall, a World War II veteran. He had served in the Army for the final months of the war. That was after he'd finished filming The Story of G.I. Joe, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. That World War II drama was inspired by the writings of the late war correspondent Ernie Pyle, and you can even find that whole film, The Story of G.I. Joe, online at sites like YouTube. HometownHeroesRadio.com is where you want to go to see some photos of our guest today, Niall Smith. They're also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Don't forget to enter that contest to win 4 tickets to Universal Studios Hollywood as we gear up for another World War II-based movie, Unbroken, Louis Zamperini's story, coming out at Christmas time. We're going to be back next week with the story of a World War II medic wounded in the Pacific. Until then, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.